This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, this is The Deep Dive on Friday mornings, as it is every week. And I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And each week we bring a conversation with somebody who is interesting, important, compelling, thoughtful, serious, and every once in a while, entertaining and humorous. And today, somebody who I've heard often in the past on television, various news channels around the world, whose articles I have seen and whose own saga is important, never had a chance to meet him. And I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to have a conversation with Gershon Baskin. He's been central to the peacemaking process in the Middle East for years and years. Many people will remember that he was the central figure in the release of Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit and wrote a book about it. But the peacemaking process, the getting to agreement, gosh, it must be a very frustrating process. I mean, it reminds me, no irreverence intended here, but it reminds me of the old story of the elderly man who has been going to the Wailing Wall for years and years and inserting one of those little messages into one of the crevices between the stones, the prayers and the wishes. And a friend of his says, "So you've been doing this for 40 years. Have your prayers been answered?" And he says, "No, it's like talking to a wall."
Yes, it's often that feeling when you're working for peace in the Middle East, particularly at a very acute, horrific, catastrophic period that we're living through now.
That is exactly what I was dreading and hoping that you would say, that you know that what you have in this struggle, I guess, is what the chess players call Sitzfleisch. You're in there for the duration. And you don't give up, and you don't wriggle away, and you sit there and just keep grinding away. I came across a comment that you wrote that says, "The reality that we have all known between Israel and the Arabs is debilitating. It stunts imagination and diminishes the ability to design policies that can change the conflictual basis of relations." And I guess that's what you just do. You do for a living. And you've come to it, university degrees from New York University, and then 2 degrees from the University of Greenwich, an MA and a PhD in the peace process. You've been an advisor to governments and other institutions. You're involved in founding, managing, guiding, and encouraging a whole roster of institutions that try to do this. I think of you a little bit like Daniel Barenboim, but not in music. I mean, he's been famous as one of the co-founders of an orchestra that brings Arab and Israeli musicians together, the East-West Divan Orchestra. But you're doing it differently. You're doing it in another way. But I'm really just pleased to have a chance to meet and talk with you, even if it is just electronically.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Do you feel like you have been talking to that metaphorical wall? Or that you see the possibilities through the wall? And how do you do this?
The bottom line for me waking up every day is the realization that between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, there are 7 million Israeli Jews and 7 million Palestinian Arabs, and we're not going anywhere. We wake up every morning with this realization that there are these two people living on this land that we each claim as our own. We not only claim the land as our own, we also claim that we give our identity to the land and we take our identity from the land. And there are so many parallels between the Israeli and the Palestinian narratives that it's bewildering that these two people can't get it together and find a way to share this land. I've been a strong advocate for most of my life for the two-state solution, that there should be a Palestinian state established next to Israel, not in place of Israel, and that these two states need to live in peace. Basically open borders and cooperation across every field of life that we know. In the last years, the vision, the idea, the hope of a two-state solution seemed to be removed from the map. It was not something discussed, not in Israel and not in the international community. It seemed no longer viable with the increase of building of Israeli settlements and the increased Israeli control in the occupied territories. The status quo situation designed by Prime Minister Netanyahu to divide and conquer, keep a delegitimized Palestinian authority in power in the West Bank and Hamas in power in Gaza, made it very easy for everyone to say Israel has no partners for peace, so therefore we can't even hold negotiations. And lo and behold, October 7th happened. The atrocities, terrorist attacks committed by Hamas, leaving more than 1,200 Israeli dead and 250 Israelis taken hostage into Gaza, and a horrendous, horrific, catastrophic war taking place in Gaza today, the two-state solution is back on the agenda. The advantage that we have today in looking at a two-state solution than we did 20 or 30 years ago is that we have negotiated this to know what are the solutions, what are the potential solutions for dealing with every single issue in conflict. If 20 or 30 years ago, when we began formal negotiations, we didn't really have an idea of how to deal with the future of Jerusalem or how to confront the issue of Palestinian refugees, how to deal with the crisis of not enough water, building economic relations, designing a border management regime that could provide security both to Israel and to Palestine. All these questions are basically known today. We have answers for them. What has changed, and this is certainly an effect of the current war, is that public opinion on both sides has moved further away from the possibility of a two-state solution than ever before. But I'm not that concerned by it, because I think that in war, people respond to the pain, to the anger, to the suffering, to the despair. We have two traumatized peoples, Israel, Jews around the world, on October 7th experienced the biggest trauma since the Holocaust. More Jews were killed in one place at one time on October 7th than at any other time since the Holocaust. And without comparison, the Palestinian people are reliving the Nakba of 1948. For the people in Gaza, it's a literal revisit of the Nakba. You have close to 2 million people who are homeless today in the Gaza Strip, who are living in tents on 20% of the Gaza Strip that has not yet been fully attacked by Israel. And it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone when we look at public opinion polls in Israel and Palestine that we find responses that indicate more extreme anti-views toward peace than ever before. But again, I think that this is temporary. And when calm returns, under whatever the circumstances are, there's going to be a shakeup of leadership, both in Israel and in Palestine. And there'll be a new generation of leaders coming along, which will offer us new opportunities to pursue new paths toward peace.
I was going to ask just about that precise point about two questions later, but I'm glad you raised it in connection with what you were saying. I mean, I'm looking at my current copy of The Economist magazine, and the cover, of which I'm sure you've seen, is an Israeli flag and then the words Israel alone, question mark. And I want to take a brief break, do an ad, and when we come back, I want you to expand a little bit on the very idea of change in leadership, changes in the kinds of leaders that will be compelled to step forward and do something different than has been done before. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, the host, and it's my delight to have Gershon Baskin as my guest this morning. And we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And our guest today is the indefatigable peace, I don't want to say peacemaker, but peace builder, I think is the phrase of art that Roger Fisher used to propound. Gershon Baskin speaking to us from Israel. And just before our break, he spoke about the need that a new crop of leaders would be necessary to make the compromises, the change, the adjustments, in spite of or even because of the current conflict and the current chaos. Could you just expand on your thinking on this?
All of the public opinion polls since the beginning of the war, and again, we have to look at them with a large grain of salt, but they've been consistent in demonstrating that the Israeli people don't want Netanyahu as our leader anymore. He has lost more than half of his base, and around 80% of Israelis want new elections to be held. The majority of those still believe that the election should be held only after the war has ended. But a growing number of Israelis are saying it needs to be done now because we don't trust Netanyahu and we can't trust him to make the crucial decisions that need to be made at this point. The cover of The Economist magazine was a case in point of Israel being isolated today in the world. The caricature in today's Haaretz newspaper is a picture of Netanyahu burning the American flag. This is unheard of. We know Netanyahu during the period of Obama made Israel an issue which ended the bipartisan nature of support for Israel within American politics. And Netanyahu is doing it once again, where he's clearly going against Biden. Most people believe that he actually wants Trump to win the elections in November. And at this time, the United States has been basically the only country in the world which is fully behind Israel's war efforts. There are a few others that have supported Israel, but not like the United States. There's never been a U.S. administration like the Biden administration in terms of providing complete and total support for Israel, politically, militarily, intelligence, everything. And Netanyahu is, I think he's off the tracks. He's lost control. And a large part of that is his need to protect himself, because when this war is over, there will be a national commission of inquiry established, headed by a Supreme Court judge, and he will be held responsible for the man who portrayed himself over years as the greatest protector of the Jewish people since Moses. Is going to go down in history as the worst leader that the Jewish people have ever had. The question is, who's going to replace him?
Yeah.
That's an open question. I mean, the obvious answer today, according to the polls, is Benny Gantz, former minister of defense, former chief of staff for the army. He leads the party, which is the strongest in the public opinion polls. He might come out on top. I think we're going to see a realignment in Israeli society. We're going to see a whole new set of young leadership rising. The people who were behind the 40 weeks of demonstrations that took to the streets in Israel prior to October 7th against Netanyahu's plans for a judicial overhaul. And I think a lot of those people are going to emerge. On the Palestinian side, it seems clear to me that what will emerge after this war is a reunited Palestinian government that will not be headed by Abbas nor Hamas. There will be a need for a temporary Palestinian administration, which can only be appointed by Hamas because there's no other legal mechanism in the Palestinian law to do that. But then Mr. Abbas, who's 87 years old, needs to step aside, become president for life with ceremonial duties and immunity for all counts of possible corruption. But it has to be someone who would be acceptable in the West Bank and Gaza, acceptable to the Arab states, acceptable to the international community, to the United States, and to Israel. There's two or three, four people I could think of who fit that bill, and that's what's going to have to emerge, because in order to enable Israel to leave Gaza, there has to be a credible military force replacing it, and that force is most likely going to be a multinational Arab-led force invited by the Palestinian government to be there for a limited amount of time to create stability and security, to be able to be a credible governing body to receive international support for the reconstruction of Gaza, and to lead to a period 2-3 years down the road when Palestinians will have the opportunity to go to elections again. Hopefully, by the time we reach there, Palestinians will understand political parties that support the armed struggle are not legitimate and cannot participate in those elections. That's what we need to head toward. In Israel, we know how to do elections. We've done them so many times. We'll see changes each time. We will not have another right-wing, fanatic, religious government leading us after this war.
The old equation, and I'm old enough to remember when the Labor Party had kind of a lock on politics in Israel. The old equation that came out of the various wars, 67 and onward, was there was about a third of the country that was prepared to have peace at almost any reasonable cost. There was a third of the country that had a more maximalist bent. And there was about a third of the country that said, if we could just postpone it all and not think about it, everything will be okay down the road somehow, some way. somewhat. What I read is that the shift has moved toward the right in recent months, even if it doesn't accept the idea that Netanyahu is the right man to lead the charge. What you seem to be saying is that the pendulum will start to move back toward the center or even toward a new direction.
I think this is clear, for me at least, that it will move further away from the right toward the center. The bulk of Israelis will be in the center. But we're going to see an international change as well, which is going to be very compelling and we're going to have to deal with. There's going to be, I believe and hope for, a domino effect of OECD countries recognizing the state of Palestine. In other words, the veto that Israel has held for the last 30 years on the question of Palestinian statehood will be removed from Israel. And the primary reason for doing that is the understanding that in order to defeat Hamas, not the military, not the organization, not the government, but the idea of Hamas is to make Palestine real for Palestinians. Palestine needs to be something that Palestinians will see, granting them freedom and dignity. And for freedom and dignity, they will be willing to make or arrive to the understanding that Israel needs to have security. They will not have freedom and dignity if Israel doesn't have security. Israel will not have security if the Palestinians don't have freedom and dignity. This is the transactional framework of any future peace deal. There are 193 member states of the United Nations. 139 of them already recognize the state of Palestine. 165 of them recognize the state of Israel. We need for all 193 states, member states of the UN, to recognize Israel and Palestine, and to make Palestine the 194th country member state of the United Nations. That will not end the Israeli occupation, but it automatically changes the parameters of the negotiations. The question of Palestinian statehood is no longer on the table. We need to negotiate borders and Jerusalem and economy and water and security and all those things, which are not simple. But it has to be done in a regional framework because Israel has neighbors who are both interested in peace with Israel, but also want the Palestinians to have peace, security, and dignity. So we'll have a table that will include Israel and Palestine and Egypt and Jordan and Bahrain and the Emirates and Morocco probably, and the Saudis have to be there. The Saudis are the cherry on the cake that Israel wants very desperately. And the Saudis will play a key role in the reconstruction of Gaza, but only on the condition that there is a clear path toward resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a two-state solution.
I'm going to interrupt our conversation. I'm going to ask you to think about this question while we're taking our ad break. The neighboring states, which is what you just went through the list, at the current moment, are they helping or hindering an effort toward, if at least the solving of the current conflict, but that larger overarching settlement that you were just eloquent on? In the meantime, let's take a station break. This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. And my guest today, to my delight and pleasure, is Gershon Baskin from Israel, a man one hears often on international media and sees in his writing, a peace builder in the Middle East. There are precious few such people, and I'm really pleased to have the chance to talk with him. We'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today, as you know, Gershon Baskin from Israel, speaking on the future, not the past irritations, not the grievances, not the who struck John first and how do we deal with our neighbors so that they never bother us again, but a man who's got his eyes resolutely, I think, toward the future. How far distant down that path, I'm not sure, but always thinking toward a future. I asked him just before the break, the role of the neighboring states and beyond, are they helping or hindering at this point? And I think maybe you can include in that roster countries beyond being just simply neighbors. I guess we could throw in Iran for that matter, and even Russia. Your views on this, sir?
Yeah, let me first deal with the Arab Sunni states that Israel has peace agreements with, they are definitely helping. On the one level, the biggest contributor of humanitarian aid in Gaza today is the United Arab Emirates. And that aid is being facilitated by Mohammed Dahlan, a former Palestinian leader from Gaza, who's from Khan Yunis. He was a classmate of Yahya Sinwar. He is a close advisor to the president of the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Zayed. And Mohammed Dahlan is a key figure in helping the people of Gaza today. And also, he's quite engaged in the talks about this change in Palestinian leadership that needs to happen in now, even before the war is ended. The Egyptians are the most important player here with regard to Gaza. They share a common border with Israel and with Gaza. And the Egyptian intelligence have negotiated over the 18 years of Hamas controlling Gaza, multiple ceasefire agreements. Every time there's a flare-up, they are deeply involved in the negotiations for the hostages and a ceasefire and an end to the war. A state that I didn't mention, but has to be brought into this discussion, is Qatar. The Qataris have been the host of the Hamas exiled leadership. They have funded Hamas with billions of dollars over the years. They've enabled Hamas to build its military machine and its tunnels and bunkers. And Qatar is a player if we want it or we don't want it. Personally, I would prefer not to have Qatar involved. I think they are a state that supports terrorism. And unfortunately, the United States has a lot of interest in Qatar, like the largest military base in the Middle East of the Americans is based in Qatar. But there are other financial and economic interests as well. Jordan is an essential player as well. Jordan has deep influence over President Abbas and can be deeply involved in convincing Abbas that he needs to step aside for a new leadership. Jordan has an enormous Palestinian population. And when there is war between Israel and Palestinians, Jordan's security and stability is at risk. Israel's eastern border since the peace treaty with Jordan in 1994 is not the Jordan River. It's the eastern border of Jordan, because there's deep military and intelligence cooperation between Israel and Jordan. Even if there isn't peace between the peoples of the Arab states and the people of Israel, there is still a strategic peace that exists between the state of Israel and those countries. There will be peace between the peoples of this region when we figure out how to resolve the Palestinian issue. That is the major issue that prevents us having much deeper, warmer peace with our Arab neighbors. Iran is a whole different story. Iran needs to be dealt with at the international level. Iran is not Israel's direct responsibility. It involves the entire globe who see the threats that Iran play today in its alliance. And the conflict between Israel and China, or not Israel and China, sorry, the conflict between the United States and China over control is something which is detrimental to the global economy. I personally would like to see China playing a role in the reconstruction of Gaza. There's no country in the world that knows how to build infrastructure faster, more efficiently and cheaper than the Chinese. And more than 2 million people in Gaza don't have houses. They don't have roads. Israel destroyed all the universities, many of the schools there. Gaza needs to be rebuilt, hopefully this time without refugee camps, but with normal, good quality standard living for people who want to live there. This is why I think there's a good chance that we will move forward on the Israeli-Palestinian track, because you know, Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, used to say the Israelis and the Palestinians have to want it more than us. That's no longer true, because the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has gone beyond the borders of Israel and Palestine. It threatens regional security. It threatens global shipping. It could lead to a war amongst the superpowers. So the international community can no longer push this problem off into the corner and say, well, someday the Israelis and the Palestinians will deal with it. That's no longer the case. The international community has to be much more genuine in implementing policies that reflect what they actually believe.
You talked a little bit earlier about the way in which Benjamin Netanyahu had politicized within American domestic politics the relationship to Israel. It seems to me that only is getting more so rather than less so. I'm always fascinated because he spent his high school years in suburban Philadelphia.
That's right.
Presumably should understand the United States rather better than that. And he spent time at the Israeli embassy in the U.S. And yet he's gone down this very, very partisan style?
Well, I think it's very clear that Prime Minister Netanyahu is a Republican. If he was an American, he would be easily elected as a senator from a red state without any problem. He could even be a candidate for president of the United States had he been born in the United States. But he is a Republican, and his policies have always demonstrated that he's a Republican. He has tolerated Democratic presidents, barely. But the difference today than in the past is that there has never been a president like President Biden who has made such an overall commitment to Israel and has demonstrated that with weapons, with money, with political support. And the caricature in today's Haaretz newspaper of showing Netanyahu burning an American flag is a very sad reflection, because the United States is Israel's most important strategic asset. We need the United States to survive. Israel has a lot of hubris and is very arrogant at times, but Israel cannot survive without the United States. The United States is the guarantor of Israel's survival. And Netanyahu is slapping Biden in the face.
I'm just puzzled by that. I understand exactly what you just said, but I remain confounded by the right word is by the hubris of the man as he deals with the United States, showing up in Washington to speak to the Republican Congressional Caucus is the kind of thing that mystifies me, when you're dependent on a bipartisan base for support. We're going to take another brief break. We'll be back in just a minute after that. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host. And my guest today, a man I look forward to speak with for quite some time, Gershon Baskin, peace builder, Israeli, and with an incisive global perspective. We'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. This is Brooke Spector, your host. My guest today, Gershon Baskin from Israel, peace builder extraordinaire. And we've been talking, obviously, about the current circumstances, the war in Gaza, the Israeli government, and the way in which it is dealing with the United States. But we would be remiss if we didn't, at the same time, also ask for your views on the role of the United Nations at this point, and separately, but I think conjoined at the hip, the negotiations that the Egyptians, the Qataris, the U.S., the Israelis, Hamas, and in various configurations have been conducting over different versions of a ceasefire and return of hostages or exchanges with prisoners. Perhaps take the U.N. circumstances first and then segue to the parallel track.
The U.N. is an international organization, certainly with a lot of problems. But even with all of its problems, it is a necessary and important organization. And one must understand that the United Nations is not just the General Assembly and the Security Council, but it is a large number of international organizations working around the world to prevent disease, to provide food. It is also an enormous collection of international conventions and agreements that manage the relationships between states. If we were just to focus on the General Assembly from an Israeli point of view, it is a body representing the nations of the world where Israel is guaranteed to lose almost all the time because the international community does not accept what is perceived by them to be the post-colonial occupation of the Palestinian people. Israel cannot win in the General Assembly as long as that's the way the General Assembly perceives the state of Israel. The Security Council has become a cynical game of global warfare where the United States uses its veto against resolutions presented in the Security Council supported by Russia and China. And Russia and China use their veto when resolutions are presented in the Security Council by Israel. This week, we had an unusual development where the United States did not veto a resolution. It abstained and allowed it to go through because they felt that there was balance in the resolution, both in calling for an immediate ceasefire, but it was not a permanent ceasefire. It's for the remainder of the month of Ramadan, and an unconditional release of all Israeli hostages. The Israelis were unhappy with the resolution because it did not include a condemnation of Hamas. But from a Israeli point of view, the resolution was positive. And it was passed without reference to the Hamas refusal to agree to the last Israeli proposal, which was on the table for a release of some 40 hostages and 700 to 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, including 100 prisoners who have murdered Israelis. Hamas rejected this deal. Hamas's priorities have changed from where they were months ago, where months ago their primary objective was the release of prisoners. Today, their primary objective is ending the war, getting Israel to withdraw from Gaza, allowing displaced people to move back to their homes that no longer exist, and increase humanitarian aid. For Israel, that's a non-starter, because that essentially leaves Hamas in power in Gaza, which is something that Israel is not going to tolerate. So we are trapped now. And the big question is, to what extent do Netanyahu and Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, actually want an agreement? I don't have an answer to that question. I believe that Netanyahu does want the hostages to come home, but he doesn't want to be the person who's going to make a deal to free Palestinian prisoners or to give in to Hamas demands. The Israeli belief is that military pressure will bring the hostages home. From what I've seen almost over almost all of the past 6 months, is that the military pressure is killing hostages. It's not bringing them home. And if the Israelis think that they will eventually get to Yahya Sinwar and the Hamas leadership in the bunkers underground and kill them, and then hostages will be released, I don't know what textbook they're reading from, because the textbook I read from seems to indicate that if Israel does find them in the bunkers, they're going to be surrounded by hostages. The bunkers will probably be booby-trapped with explosives. And even if they're not, a gun battle will erupt between the Israeli soldiers and the Hamas leadership that will kill the Hamas leadership, but also a large number of hostages. And then when the chain of command is completely broken down, there's no guarantee that Hamas fighters who are outside the tunnels are going to release hostages. Why wouldn't they just execute them? Their leadership has been killed. Why would they respond by releasing hostages? I don't understand the Israeli rationale behind this scenario. And that seems to me what's been playing out. The hostage families who were within Israeli consensus for the first months of the war have been politicized by Netanyahu and his office. So that today the hostage families, those who support reaching agreement first before everything, are perceived as being on the left. And those who are opposing an agreement with Hamas are perceived as being on the right. The hostage families organization has broken apart because of these divisions that have been implanted by Netanyahu and his cronies. And it's a horrific situation. It's tragic. It's really terrible to see this, because I believe as an Israeli that one of the things that makes our society unique is the solidarity that we have demonstrated over the years, this idea that we don't leave anyone behind. The idea that enabled Prime Minister Netanyahu and 26 ministers of his government back in 2011 to make a deal to release 1,027 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for one soldier. Because Israel has a people's army, or at least that's our ethos, that we have a people's army, we don't leave anyone behind. And if it becomes clear that the government of Israel decided to sacrifice the hostages, I think this is a damage to Israeli society that will take generations to overcome.
This must be very, very saddening to you. I mean, I sort of syncretize what you've said. My sense of it is that the Netanyahu government went ahead with this without actually having a plan B or a second act or the final scene worked out enough to be able to figure out what to do next. They, in a sense, engaged in the attack in Gaza, kind of things will work out. If we just muddle through, everything will work out fine for us, relatively speaking. You paint a picture of a scene that's rather different, let me put it that way.
Yeah, Netanyahu talks about total victory. No one knows what that means, what it looks like, and how you achieve it. We're not fighting just an army and a government. We're fighting an idea. And over the years, when Netanyahu enabled and facilitated Hamas to remain in power, that idea grew, gained more credibility, because Israel refused to negotiate with Mahmoud Abbas, who is the person who came to power on a platform of being against violence, of fighting against terrorism, of building a mechanism for security cooperation and coordination between Israel and the Palestinian security forces. And Netanyahu belittled him and delegitimized his rule in the eyes of the Palestinian people, who were able to say, what has he brought us? What achievements has he brought us? Hamas kicked Israel out of Gaza. And this is the narrative amongst Palestinians, that Hamas, through the use of violence, gained territorial control of the Gaza Strip. And if Hamas were to spread to the West Bank, they would do the same thing in the West Bank, because Israel only understands the language of force. This is their narrative. And Netanyahu plays right into that. That's why Netanyahu is dangerous for the future of Israel. I know this is difficult for Jewish listeners around the world to hear, because he's been perceived for so long as Mr. Security and Mr. Economy. But the realization is that he is doing tremendous damage to the state of Israel today.
I'm going to engage in a little amateur psychological evaluation, and I'm going to pose the question, do you suppose in some way, shape, or form, he is haunted by the shadow of his brother, his deceased brother?
I don't think so. I think he's much more in the shadow of his father. Father had great influence on him. His father was a failed academic in Israel who ended up leaving Israel because he couldn't secure a job at one of the Israeli universities. And he is the classic revisionist historian. Netanyahu grew up under his shadow of always feeling pushed aside and not respected. That's one of the reasons why Netanyahu has been able to capture the support of the lower social economic classes within Israeli society, who also felt that they were sidestepped and pushed down by the Ashkenazi establishment. These terms are still being used, even though Israel is 75, 76 years old. I mean, my wife is an Iraqi Jew, and we are a common couple in Israel of a mixed marriage, so to speak, of me being an Ashkenazi Jew and she being an Iraqi Jew. And what are my children? My children are Israelis, and the majority of Israelis, young Israelis today, are like that. They come from mixed families. And yet that there is still this sense of being humiliated, of being the lower class, whatever language you want to use to describe it. But it has been the base of Netanyahu's power. And now, because of October 7th, we are seeing his power base being whittled away. The polls show that he has less than half of the support of his base that he had prior to the war.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Gershon Baskin from Israel. No easy, happy messages, but realistic, I think, insights. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, the host. My guest today, Gershon Baskin from Israel, peace builder and something of a futurist at this point, it seems, seeing beyond the current unpleasantness to a place where it is just possible to visualize the outlines of a future dispensation. We don't have a whole lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you one other question, building on your experience in the Middle East and the vicissitudes that you have encountered. There are other conflict zones in the world today, desperate ones, in Sudan, in the Eastern Congo, in Yemen, the Ukraine, obviously, in Myanmar, Burma, as we often call it. Are there any insights you can glean from your circumstances and your work that might be applicable to any or all of the places I've mentioned?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I'm currently working for a British non-governmental organization called International Communities Organization, ICO. ICO works in conflict zones with failed peace processes, which is very natural for me here. This is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the mother of all conflicts, and we're also the mother of all failed peace processes. But we're also working in Cameroon, in Kosovo, and in Cyprus. And there are a lot of, we're now in the process of preparing training for the Anglophone separatist from Cameroon, who will be negotiators. And we're going to be working on training them, then we're doing a group of religious leaders, and then people from the French-speaking government. But sitting with my teammates, there are so many commonalities in every conflict or in every process of trying to resolve conflicts that you need to draw upon experiences. I think we have a lot to learn from South Africa. South Africa is certainly not the ideal situation in terms of personal security of people, but the South African truth and reconciliation process that happened is something that we in Israel and Palestine and in other conflicts are going to need to adjust with our own cultural set of understandings and values. But when you do get into a post-conflict scenario, you need to deal with the past. You need to deal with narratives. You need to deal with responsibility and guilt and freeing people of their guilt, of amnesty. So we have a lot to learn in those situations. I go to conferences from time to time with peace builders from other parts of the world. One of the most interesting experiences that I had was actually meeting someone not at a conference, but someone at Harvard University who was running secret direct back channels between the United States and the Taliban. And I was running, I still am, secret direct back channels between Israel and Hamas. And it was really interesting for us to compare notes of how you approach it, how you do the work, what both the technical and logistics aspects of it, but how do you talk to enemies that are committed to killing each other? So yeah, there's a lot that we can learn, and I think that peace builders and peacemakers in the world have a lot of experience that's worthwhile sharing, and there should be more platforms on which we can learn from each other.
I think there's time for a textbook on all of this, which you probably already have the rough notes for anyway.
Probably many textbooks. I did write a book, published it in English a few years ago, which was like 38 years of insights and lessons learned for me from the Israeli-Palestinian experience, with a lot of personal stories, but it goes beyond the personal stories. It's not just autobiographical. It is a lot of the lessons learned from successes and failures over the years that I've been doing this, and I've been doing it for 45 years now.
And one of the books that I read years and years ago on this kind of challenge was, of course, Roger Fisher's Getting to Yes, which set an agenda and a standard for analyses of how do you make, if not friends, but at least reluctant partners when the two sides are quite prepared to butcher each other instead.
And Roger wrote that book together with another man named William Ury. And their second book in the series, there was a whole series of these books that came out. The second book in the series was called Getting Beyond No. So it wasn't only Getting to Yes, but Getting Beyond No. And they basically created the field of research and study, negotiations theory and consensus building. And the Harvard program on negotiation still exists, and the Consensus Building Institute at MIT exists. And there's a whole lot of collaboration of those institutes and like-minded institutes around the world that have learned from Roger Fisher and from other people.
One last question for you in a real short burst, if I could. Is there a place in all of this for culture? And I don't mean the sense of the culture we, you know, each of us may have about the way we do stuff and what we eat and that kind of thing, but in the more formal sense of exchanges of culture and individuals. What came to my mind when I was thinking of it was that small but lovely Israeli-Egyptian film, really, The Band's Visit.
Yeah,
which I'm sure you've seen a number of times. Is there a role in some way for culture in any or all the things that we've been talking about?
Right. Very briefly, two aspects to it. One is that when we get back to peacemaking, peace negotiations, we're going to have to deal with the questions of education and incitement, which is a big part of culture. If you want to understand any society, look at what they teach their children. If we examine Israeli and Palestinian textbooks, we don't find societies teaching each other about the possibility of ever living in peace. Palestinian textbooks are much worse than Israeli, but the Israeli textbooks need a lot of work as well. The second aspect of culture is in the broader notion of civil society. There's a very large role for civil society to play, particularly in the absence of governments that are doing what they should be doing. We saw in this war that there was a collapse of governance in Israel, not only on October 7th, but months into the war, where the government was not providing the needs of the people and civil society kicked in. They stood up and created mechanisms to provide needs for Israelis. It's the same thing with civil society and culture. It's sports and music and theater and arts. And the more that we can expand interaction and exchange between enemies, the more bridges that we can build toward understanding. The classic example here, perhaps more than any other place in the world, is the two languages that we speak. Hebrew and Arabic are mirror images of each other. They are sister languages. And if you speak one of those languages without even knowing it, you know hundreds of words in the other language. And yet we have a psychological block in learning the language of the enemy. Israelis and Palestinians need to learn each other's language from the kindergarten, from grade one. This should be part of our curriculum, of our culture, of our experience. Because I can tell you, as someone who I learned Hebrew, but my Hebrew is much, much better than my Arabic. The more I studied Arabic, the more Hebrew I learned. It was remarkable how you see the commonalities in the languages. And it's so important because it also humanizes us.
This has been a very emotionally fraught, interesting, fascinating conversation that we've had with Gershon Baskin, peace builder. I really appreciate your time and your willingness to join us. I hope we have a chance again in the future under better circumstances with something that can be said. Take care, and you all have a good weekend, and our